dedicated to each and every one of you who appreciate a great glass of wine. You know what I mean?
It's Monday. Let's raise a glass to the beginning of another week. It's time to unscrew, uncork, or saber a bottle. And let's begin exploring the wine glass. Today, I am sharing a webinar that I attended from the Bordeaux Wine School. From their webinar description, from summer Fridays to long weekends and grill nights, Bordeaux has a style for every occasion. Did you know that the U.S. is the number one market for Bordeaux whites? Have you explored the latest Bordeaux rosés and a full range of reds? There's a Bordeaux for every budget, palate, and customer. Our experts will guide you on the latest trends and fresh ideas to enjoy Bordeaux wines this summer. While you're listening, please take a moment to rate and review Exploring the Wine Glass. Ratings are now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Audible. Taking 1 minute of your time is the only way the algorithms will suggest Exploring the Wine Glass to others. Sláinte! Hey everybody, I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program, sommelier service, champagne specialist, and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time to swipe, subscribe, rate, and review. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Give me the
blush. I'm also very excited to introduce Wendy Narby, who's an accredited tutor with the Bordeaux Wine School, as well as author, really great all-around expert of Bordeaux. She's here to lead you through the Q&A if you have questions, so be sure to engage with her. She'll come on at the end of the webinar to ask some questions live, so hopefully you're ready to get all your questions answered from a true expert. Wendy, welcome. How do you like to Bordeaux? How do you like the summer?
Well, I'm
in Bordeaux.
Well, I'm actually on the very close to the beach, just to the side of the Medoc. So I'm on the western side of the Medoc, on the beach at the moment. So it's pretty cool. So yeah, feet in the sand, I think, is how I like summer. And very excited to answer your questions. So if you've got any questions at all, please type them. I'll keep an eye on them. And then I'll answer what I can. What I can't answer, we'll put to the panel at the end of the session. So looking forward to that.
And then without delay, I will put you in the hands of Mary Gorman McAdams, Master of Wine, to introduce our panel and also tell us about your favorite summer moments.
Thank you very much, Shelley. Hi, everybody. It's an absolute pleasure to be here again and talk about Bordeaux, my favorite thing to do. So how do I like to summer? Well, in the city, one of my, I guess, favorite things that I learned to enjoy was going out to Randall's Island, where we used to watch our son playing soccer, and bring a nice bottle of wine and sit by the water and just watch the sun go down. My little idea of an island off an island, just off Manhattan. So anyway, I am really delighted to introduce our two wonderful panelists. With us today, we have fellow Master of Wine, Christy Canterbury. And Christy has worked across all aspects of the trade. So she, you know, is bringing to us a lot of experience and insights in terms of summering in the US and how we can make it a Bordeaux summer. So Christy, just if you'd like to introduce yourself briefly and tell us how you like to summer.
Thanks for having me, Mary, fellow Master Wine Study partner. It's always good to see you, even though we mostly see each other on the screen these days instead of in person to study. How do I like to summer with Bordeaux? I definitely skew to the white wines a lot. I think like so many people, I've started eating a lot lighter, more veggies, and I just think about summer green markets, picking up all that fresh produce there and cooking with that. And so I tend to drink a lot of the Bordeaux whites. And if it's really miserable, like it was yesterday, I'll drink them inside. But what I really like to do in the summer is drink them out on the balcony, where we overlook the communal terrace with its pretty flowers, and we're kind of like enclosed, so we don't hear any city noise. So it kind of feels like we have this big private garden right off of our terrace.
Fabulous. Never underestimate the New York City balcony or even a fire escape for an escape. So also with us is Jean-Jacques Dubourdieu, whom I'm sure many of you tuning in have seen many times. Jean-Jacques makes all styles of wine in Bordeaux across many properties. So Jean-Jacques, you're very welcome, and tell us how you liked summer.
Hello, Mary. Thank you for inviting me to this webinar. So we have a nice summer starting in here in Bordeaux. It's quite warm. We are around 36 Celsius. So during the week when I work in the vineyard, I have one thing I like is going to swim in the cold water of the Ciron River, which is just in the middle of the estate, actually. So it's a lot better than any other swimming pool. A bit fresh, but by this time, it's just perfect. In our region, we also have the chance to have the sea not too far, the Bassin d'Arcachon, and some oysters with a good white Bordeaux, for example, is also a good way to cross the summer.
Of course, I think we're all wishing that we were actually in Bordeaux for most of the summer. So we're here today to talk about, you know, how you can make it a Bordeaux summer. And sort of what's driving that is that oftentimes when people think about enjoying or opening Bordeaux, it's sort of as towards the end of the summer, the fall, getting into sort of the shorter, sort of colder days. But we want to talk about the wines because there's a lot of the wines that are really perfect for enjoying through the summer, not just the whites, but rosés and many of the reds. So that's probably something that people don't necessarily think so much about, you know, Bordeaux when you're thinking about sort of summer reds. So we're going to look from the market perspective and also the production perspective as to how come Bordeaux is making all these wonderful wines. So this is, I think, it sort of sums it up sort of nice and succinctly that yes, Bordeaux mostly makes red wine, but it's a lot of wine. So there's also rosé and its own unique wine, Clary, which is a slightly darker rosé, very underestimated, and something that's certainly very suitable for how we live today. We're also going to look at the dry whites, the diversity and versatility of these wine whites, and also the sweet wines. I think I was doing some work yesterday with the sweet wines, and you know, the big message is get them off the dessert list, get them off out of the sweet wine section, and really experiment with these wines with all sorts of wonderful foods, and then our little sparkling at the end. Who knew that now 1% of all wine produced in Bordeaux is sparkling, so it has its own Cremant de Bordeaux. So again, fabulous wines to enjoy over the summer. So what we want to kind of look is sort of drill down more deeply into these styles, because it's very easy to say we have white, we have rosé, we have sparkling. But what are these styles really like, and what's sort of driving the production of them? You know, what's really interesting, you know, over the last sort of decade or more, is to see the development and increase in the production of what we call sort of fruity, expressive reds. And you can really see it when you sort of taste the wines and also talk to the wine growers, how there's less influence of oak on these wines. And these wines are wines that are just juicy, delicious, and ready to drink, you know, once they're released. But they do have the Bordeaux DNA. They can still, you know, age in your cellar if you'd like that. We have the dry whites, which are just perfection in the glass in my book, just fabulously lively and bright. And there's a whole diversity of styles, which, you know, we'll talk a little bit later. So I think in many ways, it's never been more exciting. The sweet wines, we are definitely going to talk a little bit more about those, and also the Cremants and Rosés. But first, I want to, Christy, sort of bring you in and talk about from your perspective, what do you think is driving the demand for what we call these sort of lighter, brighter, fresher styles of wines?
Well, I definitely think there are a couple of things. One is that we are starting to kind of eat lighter. We are thinking more about you know, having our veggies, as mom always told us to. So I think that that definitely helps to kind of move us in the direction of kind of lighter, brighter styles of wine. So that's certainly one thing. I think that we are also drinking wine on many more occasions. It's not just for, you know, special times. It's becoming more and more of a day-to-day must-have. It's becoming more of a grocery as opposed to just something for a special occasion. And those are two very important things. And also, I think that we're kind of starting to go a little bit more outside of our typical boundaries. We're looking at, you know, not just, you know, whatever we always drink. It's not just, you know, XYZ, you know, Chardonnay or what have you. We're looking at lots of different kinds of wines. And so that's driving, and then that gets us excited. And then we go back and purchase more wines and that kind of just feeds on itself. So a couple of different things.
Okay, and yeah, certainly I think what you mentioned there, the way we sort of eat and live today, that you know, we like fresher styles, and you know, red fits into that as well. Jean-Jacques, could you talk a little bit about from your end as a wine producer, you know, what do you think is driving the increased production and focus on these styles of wines by you, you know, in your properties and also your peers, your fellow winemakers across Bordeaux?
Yeah, we are not that typical in the Bordeaux field, because in our six different family estate, we make 50% of white, dry and sweet. So I don't think we are really representative in terms of Bordeaux production, but at least what I can say is the dry white market is very dynamic. As long as we provide something to the market, actually I wouldn't say in our estate that we adapt ourselves to the market, but at least we try to bring something, to bring a flavor, to bring a special taste. I think, for example, when we sell Chateau Raymond Blanc in the United States, it's because this Sauvignon Blanc is a lot more different than Californian Sauvignon Blanc or New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. So I think as long as we bring identity, even if it's not exactly the style that people is looking for, actually, people love to be surprised. And I always prefer a consumer saying that he doesn't like my wine because it's not exactly its style, than someone saying, oh, yeah, I don't even remember if I had your wine. I don't know. I didn't have any emotion. And I think it's the main problem as a wine producer is not bringing emotion when you make wine. And it means you are not bringing anything, because a winemaker is and a wine grower and an estate and the concept itself of winery is to explain to the consumer that here the wine has another taste than there. So I think in my family, we make wine, we make dry white for a while. I think my grandfather started the first vintage of Doisiden dry white in 1948. And now it's more or less the 70th birthday of Doisiden dry. This wine is doing very well all over the world. I'm not saying it's the best wine ever, but what I'm saying, it's 100% Sauvignon Blanc on the Barsac limestone. Bring something different. And even if some people doesn't like exactly that style of Sauvignon Blanc, quite crispy and sharp, at least they recognize the style. And at least as a winemaker, we exist in a category. So I think it's our vision as a winemaker, but it's also of course different than a consumer vision. But at least it's what we feel from the production we make.
I would think that a lot of wine consumers would, I guess, share your view. I was talking to some people yesterday who said to me, I don't like Sauvignon Blanc unless it comes from Bordeaux. So that was something very nice to to hear. But something else, just kind of going back in terms of what's driving it, you know, in various conversations, you know, over the last few years with your fellow winemakers in Bordeaux, you know, I've heard, it's kind of anecdotal, but I think it sort of, you know, hits home, people saying that they're, you know, they're making these brighter, fresher styles because if nobody buys our wine, you know, I want to be able to drink it myself, and I'm making wine that I want to drink, that I can enjoy, you know, with my family, with my friends, and with my food. So I think it's fairly and squarely, it's something that people want to enjoy. They want to not so much collect these wines, but to make wines that you can enjoy with food, with friends, in a variety of settings. So I think that really sort of supports, you know, what you were talking about, Christy, the way we our lifestyle. You know, we eat more likely, and you know, we have this sort of keener interest in, you know, what's going on in the environment. But let's talk specifically about bringing it back to Bordeaux in the US in the summer. And Chris, you mentioned about the expanded consumption occasions that you're seeing. Can you talk a little bit about, well, we've sort of thrown a few key dates here on a slide, but can you talk a little bit more how you see wine, and particularly Bordeaux wine, sort of fitting into, you know, some of these key holidays in the summer?
Yes, and I will say that obviously I like to cheat and bring in other occasions, like you know, Fête de la Musique, you know, over the summer solstice. The Tour de France is coming up. That's a great reason to have a glass of wine at night when you're maybe catching up on what happened during the day. You know, Bastille Day. All of those are very fair game for popping open a bottle of wine. And you know, we don't have a lot of the sparkling wines, the Crémant de Bordeaux, but those are obviously perfect for any sort of celebratory occasion, especially so many of us are just getting back to, you know, being together and having parties and going and sitting in the park to listen to a concert, that sort of thing, or watch a movie in the park. Those are all great moments for a nice bottle of something sparkling. And of course, rosé. And we know that rosé is off the charts in popularity. While rosé should be year round, it's really a mainstay of summer for so many people. And you were talking about the different, you know, kind of the different styles of rosé before. And I really like to you know, start kind of with the kind of the paler colors of pink rosé that you can find in Bordeaux, and then bring it all the way into claret as you maybe move to dinner or move on to maybe a heavier food course or something. So that's also a great way to kind of extend a Bordeaux experience throughout a meal stay pink at the same time. But obviously, grilling foods, all those things that we do in summer. And I, you know, you were talking earlier about the fresher, brighter styles, the Bordeaux reds, and you know, so many of the the satellite appellations, even, you know, Médoc, Médoc, so many of them are Merlot dominant. And so they're just so friendly because they have kind of that plush mid palate. There's kind of still that, you know, Bordeaux earthiness, cedary note that really goes nicely with something that's grilled. And they have very svelte tannin, so really easy to drink with whatever you're having with your barbecued meats off the grill. They're not overly oaky, and they're not just really easy to drink.
Yeah, can I go back to actually quite a number of the things that you mentioned there, Christy? Well, actually, first I would like to go to Jean-Jacques, and you know, we talked about you know, how here in the US, you know, the opportunity to enjoy wine, the you know, the consumption occasions just keeps getting greater and greater, and every day is a wine day from somewhere or some style. Can you talk a little bit about, so you know, back home in Bordeaux? Are you also seeing sort of expanded consumer consumption occasions, you know, happening in terms of, you know, you and your friends and your family?
I think there is in France in the consumption there is something very seasonal. So people, as long as spring is here and summer, of course, people is drinking sometimes quite only white, actually. And when winter is arriving around the fireplace, people only want red. I mean, it's a little bit less white than before, but it still is, honestly. And then some people here in Bordeaux, from June, they only drink dry white and rosé, which is nice for us. But we feel at the worldwide scale, with all the customer and the importer we have all over the world, that the tendency of consumption of white is increasing more than the red. That is for sure. So what we feel here, I don't know if it's representing something, but we feel at the worldwide scale that white is booming, even if in Bordeaux it's not really booming. I mean, it's quite stable in proportion. The level of quality is increasing, definitely, because Bordeaux won't be the best place to produce the industrial low-cost dry white. I mean, this is not our playground. We don't have enough advantage. First of all, in terms of cost, in terms of weather, I mean, it won't be the place. But for a medium and premium, Bordeaux is a perfect place. You can have diversity between Entre-deux-Mer, between Graves, between Pessac-Léognan, between the dry white from Sauternes and Barsac around the Ciron Valley. It's a world, actually. It's a world of diversity. Definitely we feel that more and more people is interested. For example, I had a client in the United States who asked me specifically a dry white made from the Sauternes Barsac region. So it's kind of new. And as a producer, we feel it, quite recent.
Well, I'm going to come back to that in a moment, Jean-Jacques, because we are going to dedicate quite a little bit to our dry whites. But first, Shelley, thank you for launching our poll. So hopefully all our viewers will submit their answer. So what percentage of Bordeaux wines sold in the United States retail are less than $20? What do you think? How are we doing, Shelley?
Overall, they got the right answer.
Fabulous, fabulous. So all the webinars that the Bordeaux Wine School has been doing over the last 2 years are paying off. So yes, I mean, that's something that I think, even if we know it as a fact, I still think that we have some work to do in terms of, you know, when you go out to a store to buy a bottle of wine, you still probably, I think there's a legacy of thinking, well, I can't really afford Bordeaux. But to follow on from what Jean-Jacques was talking about, I'd like to talk a little bit in more detail about this diversity of white wine. And we've sort of broken it into this sort of tier one, tier two and tier three. And partly because I think historically, the dry whites of Bordeaux have often been sort of bookended, either the great famous age-worthy complex wines of Pessac-Léognan, or the cheap and cheerful, very sort of entry-level wines and fruity wines. But there's a whole world to discover, in that sort of middle tier as well. And tier one is fabulous. There are wines I would drink on a nightly basis, and there's nothing nicer than having some, seafood, or just sitting out in your garden with a bottle of Entre-deux-Mer wine or AOC Bordeaux. And these wines are, $10 to $20. So I think for any of you who are, selling these wines or thinking of buying these wines, I think today they offer tremendous value for somebody who is looking for something fresh, bright, clean, and crisp to enjoy, and often because you have that Semillon in the blend as well as Sauvignon, the wines can also appeal to that small proportion of people who say I don't really like a Sauvignon Blanc, because it sort of tempers the the boldness of a pure Sauvignon Blanc wine. But then when you're in Bordeaux, when you that pure Sauvignon Blanc wine, as Jean-Jacques mentioned, you know, has that sort of slightly riper stone fruit character, and you know, is really very quite delicious and textural. Christy, can I bring you in here just to talk a little bit about, because I know you are a lover of dry white Bordeaux and, you know, drink it a lot. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the wines that you've been enjoying and why you've been enjoying them and what you like about them, you know, across these tiers?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a huge fan, especially you know, when I drink at home, especially in the tier twos and tier threes, because you do get the complexity of blends oftentimes in there. You get maybe sometimes a little bit of, you know, a nuttiness or a toastiness, maybe from a little bit of, you know, a little new oak or maybe some older oak or larger oak, that also gives that textural dimension that you were mentioning, Mary. And I love texture, especially in wine. And I think it really helps to communicate, with food. And especially when you're, you know, when you're cooking your food, like cooked vegetables and fish and things. I do tend to like, the tier one very much with, things that are not cooked. So things that are like, yeah, salads or fresh salads now, or maybe I'm looking at the picture, obviously the oysters in front of us, or maybe some sushi. I tend to drink a lot of those ones because they're fresh, they're clean, they're about food, they're straightforward. And then I get, you know, something that's kind of very fresh and clean with, and that lets the food speak on its own, and they don't interact. They don't, I shouldn't say they interact. They definitely interact, but they don't clash together. I love the tier twos and tier threes, and the value is absolutely amazing. I mean, I think, you know, you have to get kind of almost above tier three pricing right now. If you look at some of France's other famous regions, I mean, even Sancerre is often kind of at the higher end of that tier three for their basic wines. Bourgogne Blanc is definitely at the high end of that tier three. And here you have the best wines, best white wines of Bordeaux. I think that the value just absolutely cannot be beat, really, in France overall when you look at dry white Bordeaux.
And I think going back to something that I mean, I wholeheartedly, Christy, I think it's, we always keep saying it's our little secret, you know, these fabulous wines. Well, you know, we want more people to buy them. But Jean-Jacques, going back to what you were talking about earlier, you know, about Bordeaux and the dry white, and you're not competing at that sort of very entry level. And I think it's something really important to point out about these wines. I shouldn't say even, you know, and particularly, you know, at the tier one, these wines still have one foot in the terroir. And I think that's something that really differentiates these wines, these summer wines made in Bordeaux. They're bright, they're fruity, they're fresh, but they absolutely retain their DNA of terroir. And I think that's what makes them gastronomic, that no matter, you know, how fruity they are, they still have this fabulous salinity and sense of being from somewhere that makes them really, really super to pair with food, as well as just sort of sitting back on your porch and enjoying the wines. And I mean, Jean-Jacques, you mentioned too about people looking now for, you know, a dry white from Barsac or the Sauternes area. And I think it's important to sort of point out to all our viewers is that, you know, dry white wines today are being made all over Bordeaux. So you have fabulous diversity of terroir and even sort of, you know, sort of difference in sort of microclimates, where you get this lovely range of aromas and flavors and ripeness levels. And I think it's at these price points, it's, you know, hopefully it encourages people to experiment, you know, and try these wines. And at worst, you're down, you know, $15. But yeah, so Jean-Jacques, I mean, you make a lot of white wine, and you know, you were talking about your dry white in Noisy-Den. But across the range, you know, Grave, you have your dry white Bordeaux Blanc. So are you seeing also in Bordeaux this increased production across the region? And often regions that traditionally make red wine also making dry whites?
Actually, as I told you before, we feel for the moment the proportion quite stable. But if you consider the historic actors of dry white, or the the strong label, I would say. This part is increasing. I think the wine production is specializing itself right now. And those who are well known as a signature of white are quite growing, actually. But the dry white category overall is for the moment stable. But I think it will increase because of what we say, what we consider before at a worldwide scale, people is drinking more and more white. Also, we are more and more sensitive to all the spring frost aspect. I mean, the dry white is even more sensitive than the red. So in a way, it's more fragile. So from a side, the consumption is increasing. And from another side, it's more and more difficult to product white. And also a very warm summer is also an issue. For the dry white production, so I think in some places Bordeaux could plant some more white, especially on some north exposure, in some deep clay, or in the very few limestone places we have, because actually we have few limestone in Bordeaux, but actually there is some area of limestone isolated. There is some in Entre-deux-Mers, there is some in Graves, there is some even in Médoc. So in all this little mosaic, it's possible to make a great white with a nice identity, with a nice diversity. And as long as the wine counts a story, it's working. It's always working, because we always find a community all over the world who lies this identity, and it's really what we feel. So sometimes, as a producer, you always wonder if you have to paste to the market or to present a very unique style. And actually, it's a dilemma. It's a question that every producer can ask himself. But what we feel in our specific production is, what is working better is to propose a strong identity. Where it's always better than trying to paste to a market which is anyway moving all the time.
Well, I think Bordeaux and Bordeaux White is doing quite well. And I think maybe our viewers know, or maybe they don't, that the United States is the number one export market for Bordeaux's dry whites. So thank you, all of you who are tuning in, who have made that possible, and hopefully will continue to do so. Just before we move on, because we've got to talk about, you know, our reds as well, but I think it's just important to sort of remind people of the varieties. We've got, you know, Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, Muscadelle, and Sauvignon Gris. So with this fantastic palette of grape varieties, it really enables the producers to create these wonderful, you know, blends and this diversity of styles, as well as you often see the increasing production of varietal wines from these varieties as well. So plenty to choose from, fantastic price points, and really wines that go with everything, you know, all the way from just sipping outside to, you know, a wonderful complex meal. Okay, so let us now talk about the refreshing modern reds. And Christy, I'm going to start with you. Could you talk a little bit about, we have some sort of points here on the slide, but could you talk a little bit behind those as to, you know, why they're refreshing, why they're modern, and why we should be enjoying them, and how we can enjoy them?
Yep, absolutely. There's such a great line of acidity in all these wines, because these are, you know, French wines made for food, made for the table. And so there's always a great underlying freshness in them. And of course, there's Mary was just talking about the red grape variety, the white grape varieties, but you know, red, we've got, of course, Cabernet Sauvignon, but I mentioned Merlot before, which can be, you know, soft and round and lush. But we also have Cabernet Franc, which is so beautiful. It's very aromatic, and it's a great provider of acidity for wines that are kind of easy easy to drink and very summer ready. You know, a lot of these wines that are super easy to drink, ready to drink young, ready to drink when they're released. You know, we're seeing lots of 19s in the market in the U.S. Quite a few 18s are here. They're ready to go. These aren't wines that need to be, you know, tucked away under the in the closet or under the mattress in New York City or in your cellar if you have more space somewhere. But they're ready to drink now. They don't have a lot of oak. They're really about pure fresh fresh fruit, and that's all that you need to pop the cork on them. As I mentioned before as well, a lot of them really are dominated by Merlot. So you know, Merlot tends to have kind of cuddly tannins, makes them wines very easy to drink very early on, also these wines can, you know, if you think about wines that you want to drink in summer, something that's kind of, you know, light, easy, maybe something, a red from the Loire or a Beaujolais. You know, these are great wines to kind of to switch in and out with those wines, especially if you're catching on to that trend of, you know, chillable reds, which, you know, at least cellar temperature, but maybe even a little bit cooler than cellar temperature wines that are great for picnics, for drinking outdoors when it's warm, for taking on a hike with your, you know, sausage or saucisson and cheese, that sort of thing. All of these make the wine super easy to drink. And also, of course, they're very approachable for your pocketbook.
Absolutely. And I think what you say about the Cabernet Franc, and it's not like Bordeaux is going to change and all the reds are going to be Cabernet Franc 100%, but just that little bit of Cabernet Franc in the blend, you know, really adds that sort of light, bright perfume and additional freshness to the wine. But at the same time, you know, to your point about Merlot, I say regularly that I think Bordeaux gives Merlot a real reason for living. And I think, you know, don't ever sort of underestimate the, you know, those cool, deep clay soils that really retain the freshness in Merlot. And, you know, there's plenty of those deep clay soils around Bordeaux. And I think it's sometimes we underestimate how wonderful, you know, Merlot can be. And to your point, Christy, about the, you know, the less oak and, you know, chillable. There really is a trend too. And what I'm seeing, I'm not making wine in Bordeaux, but I talk to a lot of people who make wine in Bordeaux. And, you know, what I'm hearing is sort of like less extraction and more about preserving the purity of fruit expression that comes in from the vineyard, and then not sort of masking that with oak. And I think that's what you're tasting, Christy, when you're tasting, you know, these young, very bright, fresh wines.
Yep. And can I just pop in there too, because we didn't talk about the second label wines, and I'm just looking at the slide, of course, now, and I'm like, oh gosh, I've been drinking a lot of the second label wines from all over recently, which are, of course, meant to be drunk a little bit younger. Some of them can be aged, but most of them are really ready to drink, you know, now while you're waiting for the Grand Vin, the big wines to come around. It's also really interesting. I've been tasting drinking a lot of the 2017s lately, and they're just, you know, a much lighter style of vintage, and they're absolutely positively fantastic and super gently priced, even for some of the higher end second label wines. They're really delightful. Not necessarily always chillable, but definitely cellar temperature wines, and just some really brilliant 2017 second labels. I'm so excited that I randomly bought a couple of them about 6 months ago, and I have been buying more since, just absolutely loving those.
That's a really important point, Christy, is, you know, not to fear, you know, vintages that are not lauded as the greatest sort of collector vintages, because if that's all I bought, I'd be dead before I get to enjoy them. So, you know, you've got these lovely sort of classic vintages where the wines are just beautifully fresh. But there are so many of the appellations across Bordeaux where you know, today you just find these fabulous, fresh, bright just juicy wines, and you know, I say Merlot dominant with some Cabernet Franc as well. So we want to talk a little bit as well about, we mentioned earlier the rosé, the sweet and the sparkling, and I think for a lot of wine consumers here, they probably haven't had that much experience with these styles of wines. So hopefully, you know, we are seeing more come into the market, and hopefully we will continue to see more and more come into the market. That, you know, rosé is certainly, you know, a style that continues to be in demand. And, you know, I think that, you know, Bordeaux is playing in that rosé field as well. But I want to talk to you both about this, because I, you know, I see that, you know, the rosé market, it's a very competitive market, and you can't really come in and be just another sort of rosé producer. But Christy, I'll start with you maybe. What do you see in terms of rosés from Bordeaux? How do you think they do, can or should differentiate themselves and position themselves on the market?
Yeah, I think, first of all, the first point is probably the most important, because we want to talk about that whole, the second point, which is that color range, which can be quite wide in Bordeaux. And you do see kind of that super pale, you know, kind of baby girl pink rosé coming out of Bordeaux. But you'd often see the wines with a little bit more color. I mean, the grape varieties, you know, Merlot, Cabernet, they, you know, this isn't, you know, Grenache that's meant to be, you know, super pale necessarily. These are wines that have more color to them. But regardless of what the range of color is, if it's a Bordeaux rosé, it is bone dry.
And now a word from our sponsor. Exploring the Wine Glass is brought to you by Dracena Wines. Dracena Wines is an artisan winery located in Paso Robles, California. They have been producing wine since 2013. Their first vintage began with one wine, their classic Cabernet Franc, which received a 91 in Wine Enthusiast. Since then, they have increased production as well as expanded their portfolio, have received many accolades, including multiple double gold medals and consistent 90-plus ratings. Visit their website, www.dracenawines.com, or use the link in the show notes to schedule a private tasting and to see their entire portfolio. Purchase your award-winning wine and let Dracena Wines help turn your moments into great memories.
And I find that a lot of the Bordeaux rosés tend to have a little bit more structure. They are, whether it's more color, more structure, there's just more, there's more firmness to them. They're definitely, I think, wines that are really still made for the table, as opposed to sipping, you know, on the balcony. And absolutely, they're great for that too. But I think they're very much gastronomic rosés. And they're also rosés that can take some food with personality. They don't have to be just with, you know, delicate seafood or a salad or something. And they can take something off the grill because they do have that more, that structure, more concentration, and a little bit more of a depth of flavor with the blends.
And I think you see here too, in the market, that the market for rosé is segmenting. You know, there's opportunities for higher end rosés, gastronomic rosés, even rosés that have some oak aging. So I do think that you know, for Bordeaux coming into the market, you know, not just being sort of a very simple fruity pale rosé, can be a good thing. And, you know, really have those dry terroir-driven wines. Jean-Jacques, you know, you've made some rosé. You have the Clos Floridain rosé. I remember enjoying many times. Can you talk a little bit from your perspective as a producer of rosé, what you see in terms of what you want to produce and feel the market is looking for?
Actually, we try to make the rosé exactly like we make the dry white, so no rosé de saigné, no blood rosé. It's a direct pressed. Actually, we have all the chain, all the machinery to vinify excellent rosé with a pneumatic press under nitrogen. I mean, we have everything to make a very aromatic rosé, especially with some very good Cabernet. So actually, we are quite, I mean, even if for us, it's staying a niche market, But as long as we try to count a new story around a very aromatic and fresh rosé, we love pressed rosé because there is less alcohol, higher acidity, it's fruitier. So now the main thing is how to give value to this. And little by little, there is more and more demand. And the difficulty when you are wine producer is you always have to make a little bit less wine than what you are able to sell. So that's why we are going quite slowly, because it's a lot of investment and we don't want to produce something that we are not able to sell. But we have to say that a good rosé made like that, so a good Cabernet Sauvignon rosé on some cold places, vinified like a dry white, in a fancy bottle, of course, because I mean, rosé belongs to a special market with a special code. It's working quite well. So it's not it won't be, I think, a huge market for us, not like the dry white. But I have to say that it's growing. So I mean, we consider it seriously.
Thank you. Yeah, no. So I think it is growing, and I certainly hope to see more examples here. Just before we launch into talking about a trade survey that we conducted recently, I just wanted to take a little bit of time about our Crémants and the sweet wines of Bordeaux. Maybe some of you know, and maybe some of you don't, that Bordeaux makes a Crémant, a sparkling wine traditional method, and you know these wines. There's not too many of them in the market yet, but I think they're increasing. They typically are made as a white wine or a rosé wine with Sémillon, Merlot, Cabernet Franc. And actually, I tasted one yesterday that had 20% Uni Blanc, which was actually really delicious and really added an interesting backbone of acidity to the wine. And then the sweet wines, there's a lot more going on in Bordeaux than Sauternes and Barsac, which are the legendary, fantastic sweet wines, and obviously Jean-Jacques, that's part of your DNA. But there are many more areas and appellations, and particularly along the right bank of the Garonne, appellations called like Loupiac, Cadillac, Saint-Croix-du-Mont, which offer tremendous, not just value, but also these wines are ready to enjoy much earlier, and they're brighter, fresher. And I think there's a whole opportunity in the summer to enjoy and share these wines with fried chicken, some barbecue. So I'll start with you, Christy, and I know we don't have that much time left, but maybe taking the sparkling and the sweet wines, could you talk a little bit about what you see from a kind of a summer wine perspective using these two styles of wines?
Yeah, I think that the Crémants have a gravitas. The Crémants de Bordeaux have a gravitas, and I think especially with the Merlot, Cabernet Franc, they have a little more weight to them than some of the Crémants d'Alsace or Crémants de Bourgogne. And I think that's great for the summer barbecue, the summer summer foods that have just a little bit more heft to them. So I'm a big fan of them for that reason. And I also think that they, when you do find them, which is not very often right now, we're going to change that.
Any importers there, look for them.
Yes, please, we want them. They often are more reasonably priced even than Crémants from other parts of France. I think they're extremely, it's extremely gentle on the wallet. And then white sweet Bordeaux, I really love the ideas with kind of the brighter, fruitier styles of the Thai food. And I'm just thinking of like the Thai salads that just have, have bursts of flavors. I love the idea of pairing those kind of medium sweet wines. And it is important to mention, these aren't necessarily as sweet as Sauternes. You're kind of looking at wine geek alert, talking about residual sugar, but kind of more on the 40 to 80 grams per liter of residual mm-hmm. sugar. So, and of course, balanced by plenty of acidity, but they're not that as unctuous necessarily as Sauternes and Barsac. But my favorite way to serve sweet white Bordeaux is always at the beginning of a meal. Because when people come over, well, we start with something, you know, bubbly to begin with for sure. But then when we move to the table, I like to do something sweet because no one will say no. They might at the end of a dinner say, oh, I'm just finishing my red, or I have too much, I've had plenty, or oh, I have to drive, or whatever. At the beginning of the meal, they never say no. And everyone is, everyone loves sweet wine. Whether they want to admit it or not, everyone loves them. And it's a great way to remind people that they should be drinking sweet wine, and they never refuse. So that is my little tip.
I think that's a really valid point. You know, start with the wines. I remember our fellow wine professional, Jeff Harding, director at the Waverly, and hosting a dinner one evening. And we started out with a second label of a Sauterne wine, so a nice young wine, we all had a packet of Lay's salt and vinegar chips. And it was just fabulous. I mean, anyone could do it. And it was just a perfect way to turn everything on its head. And we started with the sweet wine. So there, and I think what you said is really important, that these wines are not as sweet. So ranging from, you know, sort of the 40s up to about, you know, 80 or 90 grams compared to, you know, the richer Sauternes Barsac wines, which not to take from them, they're fantastic wines, but for something that's lighter and sort of easier drinking. So I think we should move on to the, we did a survey, and Christy, you've been sort of looking at that. We all have. Can you talk a little bit about what, I guess, what our peers are telling us across the country about what they're seeking out and what their criteria for summer wines?
Yes. Well, no surprise. Rosé is certainly very popular. But it was quite interesting that some people were saying, some wholesalers were saying that dry whites are really going to run dry this summer because they're going to be so popular. Obviously, value is always a play with everyone, especially now that we're going back out and dining in restaurants as well. A couple of things that people are talking about in terms of what they want to sell. People want they want a good story. And one of the things that we know about Bordeaux is that we have lots of very small producers, family producers, going back generations and generations. We also have lots of kind of young up and comers. We get some young guns on the scene. So there's definitely always a way to sell. Got to answer my survey here. To sell the story here, we've been talking about food pairings, and of course, whether you're in a restaurant or buying a wine at a store, almost everyone that we surveyed said, you know, we need to know how to pair the wine with food. Just knowing in general that Bordeaux, you know, there's lots of Atlantic influence, the influence of the rivers, and there's plenty of freshness in Bordeaux wines. They're definitely wines that are made for the table, as you would expect from any European wine and certainly a French wine. So those are two unexpected criteria. But what we're seeing more and more for the people that are buying the wines to resell to consumers who aren't quite demanding it as much just yet is sustainability. You know, is this wine made from organic grapes? Is this wine made by people who are paying attention to whatever, maybe their carbon footprint or other actions that we need to be taking to think about our green earth and try to keep it greener? Some other concerns that people have over the summer are going to be obviously supply chain. It is the two words of the of the year, maybe along with inflation. But also people are concerned about staffing shortages. But I think that Mary and Jean-Jacques can tell everyone there's going to be no supply shortage of Bordeaux wines this year, right?
Yeah. Absolutely not. I mean, the good thing is Bordeaux does make a lot of wine. And I think as we saw from the first poll is that over 70% of the wines sold here sell for under $20. So I think that survey response about value being key. Also, you know, you talked about the concern for, you know, the environment. And I think we, you know, we've seen over the last 20 years the enormous strides that Bordeaux has made in terms of sustainability. And today that the area of the Gironde is the fastest growing in terms of either organic or in conversion to organic. So there's enormous amount going on there. And And then the other point I think that came out from the survey was the story, the family, and, you know, as we see it in person with Jean-Jacques, and, you know, most of the wine estates in Bordeaux are family-owned, not just family-owned, but family-worked as well. So there is that story. There is the generational aspect, and also, to your point, the young people who've sort of moved into some of the, I guess, affordable areas of Bordeaux to start making wine. So it's almost like that demand from the survey is made for that, you know, palette of wines coming out of Bordeaux. Jean-Jacques, is there anything that you would like to, have you kind of noticed from the survey or anything that you'd like to comment on in terms of what the trade is saying?
Yeah, I didn't realize that, I mean, we know that value in France, we know that the value is a big issue because in France, a significant part of the wine sales are under 10 euro. Actually, we are in also a country where we produce wine, so it's normal in a way. But I see that in the estate, it's also a big issue. Environment is an issue which is normal. Actually, here in Bordeaux, we realize that a lot of people were doing a lot of things actually for years. Yeah. But now we learned how to communicate about that. For example, I mean, my family has a bee house in the middle of the vineyard for one century. We never communicate about that. Now, yeah, we do, because we feel that the consumer, the importer, the wine professional need to understand what is your impact on the environment and what we do. And I think it's even wider than a certification, because I mean, there is many certification. We have a lot of certification, I won't even precise which one. But I think we need to be very cautious, because we feel that the consumer is also feeling all the certification as a kind of greenwashing. And what he wants to feel when he has an experience in the winery, when he checks the website, when he drinks the wine, he wants to feel the impact on the environment, what we do in the long-term view. And I feel it more and more important. And for example, all the certification now, we feel it when we host people in the winery. Actually, they don't really care about certification. They want we talk about our energy production, about our CO2 emission, about the forest we plant, about the renovation of the old house of our village. About the fact that we create employment locally, I think a winery has to communicate a lot also on all these aspects, because it's a very long term aspect, and the consumer is more and more concerned by that. Otherwise, a certification is another certification above another one, and I think we really have to count the story, and we have a nice story. Every winery everywhere in the world has a nice story, because we have land, we have forest, we have a roof with a solar panel, we can retreat all the water we consume, we can even be completely independent in terms of energy, of water, of fertilizer. Every winery in the world, and there is always a very nice scenario to count. We always had, actually, but now we feel that consumers want to listen to this scenario. Maybe 10 years or 15 years ago, not that much. Now it's really important. So
I think that's what you said is so true, and certainly my observations over the decades sort of going to Bordeaux is that lots going on, but nobody's really kind of talking about it or telling people what you're doing, and I think to your other point, it's there's a much more holistic approach and view to the long-term viability, the kind of the regenerative agro ecology, agroforestry approach. So, yeah, I think that sort of fits in with what I guess the industry is looking for. I know we're sort of coming up at the top of the hour, and I just want to sort of, I guess, collate our takeaways. I think hopefully that those of you who are sort of watching with us today now kind of see, yeah, you know, I should consider Bordeaux as my summer wine and look across the stars, certainly the diversity of stars and the affordability. And I think we've talked a lot about how, you know, the many occasions we can use these wonderful wines. But I know we probably have some questions, so I am going to hand you over to the wonderful Wendy Narby, who is going to take our Q&A. Thank you, Wendy.
Pleasure. Well, there aren't many questions because I think you've answered them all with everything you're talking about. But one question came up was about Claret. So you talked quite a lot about rosé. And if you can just touch a little bit on Claret, the difference between Claret and rosé, and can we find Claret in the US, I think is the question.
Okay, a lot of questions there. Well, as they are producer, you know, on our panel, Jean-Jacques, would you like to talk a little bit about the, from a production perspective, what is Claret compared to a rosé? And then, you know, Christy and I, we can talk about the market and what's here.
Okay, so I'm not a Claret producer, but I have some information, some clues. So I know this this market is quite dynamic, and all the Claret producers are doing very well. In the process, it's a Claret, so it's a little bit darker and fruitier. I mean, it's Claret is very interesting, but it's staying quite a niche production in Bordeaux, huh? quite a nice value in the meantime for the consumer, but also for the producer, because sometimes with the regular simple rosé, not all the wine growers are making enough. We are not even talking about making money, but just paying the cost. So Claret is a very win-win production, because consumer love the style, and the producer is making a living with, which is also an issue. So as far as I know, it's a very dynamic little niche market working and growing well.
And I think it's a product we'd like to see more of here. And might I just add, in terms of the, I guess, the production, it's sort of defined by the density of color. So, you know, in its sort of production regulations, compared to a rosé, there would be a little bit more sort of specificity in terms of the amount of color that would need to be, you know, extracted. So, you know, it falls between a rosé and a light red, where you do have a nice little bit of tannin, that deeper color, but it's also much lighter than a regular red. And as a wine drinker, as a wine consumer myself, and someone who loves Claret, I would certainly love to see more of the wines here. There are a few, but I think they tend to be in, and Christy, I don't know what you're seeing out, but they tend to be in key sort of urban cities, and not here all the time.
Yeah, I think a challenge for Claret is the deeper color. People aren't accustomed to that, and there's an association that rosé is supposed to be super pale. I don't agree with that. Rosé can come in any color it wants to and be wonderful and dry. But I think that it's fighting a little bit against that. So that's one of the reasons that we don't see much of it. And of course, not much of it is produced. But I look at Claret and I love the fact that it really is the perfect wine between not even just white, but rosé and red. I often say, well, you know, when you're to sommeliers that I'm training or even servers that I'm training, it's like, if someone says white, someone says red, then rosé is a great way to go. And Claret is really like the perfect rosé to go to for that, because you do get the body, you get something that is still chilled, you get something with some texture, you get a little bit of tannin, as you mentioned, so it's not all that far from a red in that regard. And I think it's a perfect solution for all those times when you have people that kind of want different things, but you can kind of give it to them in a Claret, a rosé in general.
Yeah, and I think it segues into that sort of how we dine today, and yet it, you know, it has a little bit of tannic grip for somebody who kind of would like a red wine. So again, you know, I think you know all of this in terms of the market is about supply and demand. So you know, we want to encourage more production of it, and then also hopefully incite and engage more of a demand from this side as well. So maybe, you know, any of you who are bringing in Bordeaux, maybe look for the Clery from the producers sort of the next time.
Yes, please.
Yeah. And we have a question about clones for the dry white wines, Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon. There's a question, are the clones being developed or are the clones available that can hold their acidity better, if I presume in the question is asked in the context of climate change?
So that's definitely for you, Jean-Jacques.
Yes.
That's Jean-Jacques' question.
So right now we have, there is no new, I mean, as far as I know, there is no new clone specifically helping for a high acidity and low pH. I mean, nothing new that we already have. But the biggest effect in terms of global warming and lack of acidity and freshness is the place where we plant dry white. So, of course, with the south exposure on very gravel and sandy places in a warm place, even with the best clone, with the biggest OGM, anyway, it won't work. So the clone has a big impact than the choice of where we plant the vine. Mm-hmm. And during many time, we were considering some cold places, not really interesting for wine in general and even for white. And now, even in my own estate, in some places with the north exposure, even a bit in the middle of the forest, with some shadow in the morning, now we are considering this place to make a fresher white. So concerning the clone, we are more or less at the end of the way. I mean, with what we have available, because now when you want to plant 1 hectare of Sauvignon Blanc, you have to book your plant quite 12 months or 18 months before. So when you have the chance to book a good plant with a good rootstock, because before talking of the clone, we have to find the right rootstock adapted to clay, adapted to limestone, adapted to gravel. So what we feel is the that we call the Sauvignon Gris or Sauvignon Rose is not that well adapted to global warming. It's not the fresher one. My father planted a lot of pink Sauvignon and gray Sauvignon in the 80s. He made some trip in the Napa Valley in Australia, and bring back this idea. Now we quite quit all the pink and gray Sauvignon, at least in our estate. I'm not saying generally, but it doesn't seem the best adaptation to keep the freshness and acidity. Another aspect is the orientation of the vine. So in the past, we consider that planting north south was the best option in terms of maturity, because you directly get the light of the sun, which is arriving from the east. Now, and we just plant 1 hectare in Clos Floridane this year, we did exactly the reverse. So east-west, especially to avoid direct impact of the sun, and in a way to make the maturity a bit slower. So we change many things, and until now we feel that it has a biggest impact. Also, the date of harvest. And now we are harvesting Sauvignon Blanc to get it crispy in August. When I was a little boy 35 years ago, we were starting the harvest September 10. So there is many leverage until now, which has a biggest impact than the clone. But maybe one day we will find something. But until now, nothing really evident.
And Jean-Jacques teed up our next webinar, which will be all about the environment. So we don't have a date yet, but we'll be sure to share that. I'm just on to say our time is up. We went a little bit over, but thank you everyone for joining us. Thank you to our panel. I wanted to let everyone know that there is a downloadable handout. Hopefully you saw it. It'll also be on the recorded version, but it will have tips, summer calendar, talk about food pairings and how, you know, keywords for each of the styles of wine. And Mary, any closing thoughts that you have?
Well, I'm going to make sure that I've got plenty of Bordeaux in my summer kit. I think, you know, I sometimes I feel we're just, you know, we're saying these wines are so suitable for the summer. And, you know, we all know that these wines are very affordable. But it's something that I think to consciously think about when you're going out to stock up for the summer or, you know, in a retailer, organize your shelves, because the wines are fabulous, fabulous deliciousness, fabulous affordability, and really there's so many diverse styles to suit every taste.
Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Jean-Jacques, Christy, Wendy, Mary.
Thank you very much. Give me the
wine. This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I am also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoytbud. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe to help others find me more easily. And most importantly, tell your wine-loving friends, because if you like the podcast, they will too. Music is Wine by Kevens. Until next week, sláinte. Sweet Merlot, give me that.